Hello, everybody, and welcome to another episode of Westworld Down the Rabbit Hole. This will be a recap and breakdown of Season 2, Episode 6, Phase Space. And any eagle-eared listeners out there will know that we weren't on last week. Had some unfortunate, embarrassing technical difficulties. In fact, those same technical difficulties befell me again yesterday. I'm really just too embarrassed to even say what it was that happened, other than to say that, I'll say what happened. I totally didn't archive what I was recording. I didn't save it, and so far I didn't have a file, and I talked into a microphone for a long time and nothing came of it. Very unfortunate, very tragic. And this actually, believe it or not, this is my third go-around for recording this. I actually sat down a little earlier at my home studio, which isn't really a studio at all. And unfortunately, it got pretty noisy for the second half of everything that I was recording. Something a little bit beyond my control. And so I escaped to a proper studio that I could come and record in. Unfortunately, it's 90 degrees in here, and I am dying. So we're going to buzz right on through our recap, and it's going to be my third go-around on it, so trust me, I know everything I'm talking about because it's the third time I've said it. I'm going to do things a little bit different than I did the first two times I recorded this, not that anyone will know because you didn't hear the other... Anyways... Did I mention I'm on my own today? Isn't that tragic? It was mostly due to the Memorial Day weekend and just conflicting schedules between me and my co-host. So y'all are stuck with me. Hopefully, though, and I'm just going to say it right up front, we're trying to get out another episode later on this week where we're just going to kind of put together a lot of the theories and things of that nature for the most part to... just kind of organize all of the thoughts all into one place. Because a lot of the time, sometimes I'll get off onto a tangent while I'm talking about certain parts of the plot or theories, and we come back to it, and I don't always super elaborate deep into some of the theories, or sometimes I don't touch on, like, what's vogue at the moment because it wasn't necessarily a part of the episode. So a little later on this week, stay tuned. We're going to get a theories episode out. Look for it around Friday or Saturday. Something around that time. It's going to be a little later in the week. And as I go through the recap here, I think what we're going to do, and we're actually going to skip the opening scene until almost the end, we're going to recap this based on characters. So I think the best way to start out is let's wrap up Shogun World. You know, I didn't recap any of it last week. And Real quick then, let's just recap last week in like 10 seconds. Last week was a good episode. I enjoyed it, but at the end of the day, it was still filler. Nothing really happened that advanced the plot other than the opening scene and watching Dolores completely alter Teddy's attributes. Those were like the two really big things that happened last week, and everything else was just kind of consequential. That's really all there is. The Shogun World turned out to be a mirror of Westworld. There we go. I just recapped 45 minutes of the episode for you. Now let's get on to Phase Space. I really do. You know, like, it was a good episode, but if I was going to have a technical problem with an episode, I'm kind of glad it was that one, because there really wasn't a whole lot that happened during that episode. At least the way I was looking at it. I think there were some interesting things from last episode that pieced together to this episode, and we'll get to that in this recap. So let's start out in Shogun World with Maeve. We pick up kind of where we left off, or maybe about like 10 minutes where we left off. The army has been defeated, and these guys are just kind of cleaning up everything. Akane goes and cuts out Sakura's heart. She intends to give her a proper burial, and then they head on back to that Sweetwater town. And when they get there, Tanaka, the former, I guess he's the former captain. I mean, there's no Shogun anymore. The former captain of the guard, Tanaka, comes out with his hostages, you know, Hector and all of them. And he wants Akane to give herself up. And Maeve's about to Jedi mind trick him into killing himself. But Musashi intervenes. He kind of like cuts her train of thought off. And he insists that the two of them duel. We get this really epic duel between Musashi and Tanaka, one that Akane wanted Maeve to interfere with. And we kind of get like a bit of a line that just kind of there's a setup for it, and the payoff is just a little later on, where Maeve says that she won't interfere because we each deserve to choose our own fate, even if that fate is death. And despite Tanaka fighting a little dirty, Musashi ultimately defeats him, beheads him, totally awesome, and wins the heart of Akane in the process. Hey, what do you know? And then on to Snow Lake. Woo! We get to Snow Lake through the bamboo forest. That was really cool. And then the view of Snow Lake, even cooler. They go down, they burn the heart of Sakura as part of like a funeral pyre of sorts. The humans and the host kind of split ways. The humans went to find the way back to Westworld, back down into the Delos facility specifically. And then Lee comes back over, gets Maeve, says, you know, it's time to go. Maeve tries to get Musashi and Akane to come with her to start a new life with her now that they know what's going on. And they insist on staying, with Akane using the same line back to us, saying, we each deserve to choose our own fate, even if that fate is death. And Maeve's okay with that, which is really interesting because that is so not how Dolores has been operating. She took that choice away from Teddy last week, whereas we see Maeve in this instance allowing people's choices, and whether or not it's total free will or not, but allowing people to make these choices and to live or die by them on their own without her interference. Definitely makes her more of the good guy than Dolores, that's for sure. And the girl with the dragon tattoo, who is Japanese Armistice, she joins them because, let's face it, realistically, her skills are more practical in Westworld anyway. Musashi is really cool up close when he's fighting someone else with a sword. But more than likely, he'd get shot by some guy on horseback, and that would be the stupidest, lamest death ever. At least Japanese Armistice stands a fighting chance. And it's still awesome that even when we see her later on in her Western attire, she's still got her sword. I thought that was so cool. But they do. They eventually make it to the prairies, and the scene we all thought was going to play out ends up being the scene that totally does play out, which is that Maeve finds her daughter. Daughter doesn't recognize her, has a new mom. And when Maeve, suddenly you're thinking, all right, is Maeve going to kill this woman or steal the daughter? Ghost Nation conveniently shows up, led by Akichida, who was the dude who recruited, you know, along with Angela, who courted Logan in episode 2. And he's also been, he was in the other, one of the other Ghost Nation scenes, the one with Stubbs, in 2 episodes ago. But and they did. They said he was going to have a pretty big role. And so they show up. It seems to be that they kill the girl's new mother. Wow. Nice and convenient for Maeve, I guess. She didn't have to make the decision. And so she grabs her daughter. I don't think she has a name yet. So it's just weird to say it's her daughter when it's clearly been programmed to be someone else's daughter at this point. But she grabs her daughter. She makes the getaway. Akichida catches up to them. And he says, come with us. We are meant for the same path. And she responds in Lakota to him, your path leads to hell. And that's when Hector and Armistice and Japanese Armistice show up, and they're kind of scaring off Ghost Nation. They're shooting some of them. And we see Felix, Sylvester, and Sizemore kind of laying low in the grass, grappling with what to do. Felix suggests they go help, and then Sizemore, the coward that he is, but you know we've kind of come to like Sizemore, but let's face it, Sizemore has since the beginning of the show, but specifically this season, he's always looking out specifically for himself. And that's exactly what he's doing here. He pulls out that radio that we saw him lift last episode and says that he's going to call for help, meaning he's going to give their location away. Felix is clearly against this, and then we see something interesting from Felix, which is he decides that he's going to go help, and he actually leaves to go try and save a host and to assist other hosts. So that was really interesting and a really cool, I get, and I guess I shouldn't say it's surprising. It's almost like you would expect that from someone like Felix after the events of last season, even for him reprogramming that little bird and how much care he took of it. And it seems like the reasonable thing for a character like Felix to do. But that wraps everything up in the Maeve storyline. So let's tackle our other kind of easy to tackle, somewhat separate from everything storyline. And that's good old William. Although I like to just call him Bill when we're talking about old William. So Bill's riding along with Lawrence. Where is my sheet with that? It's right here. They're riding along. They find an overturned wagon with arrows in it. And Lawrence sends his men up to go investigate it and then rides on after them. And then Emily comes up and she's riding along with her dad. And he's not even convinced that she's real. He actually criticizes, like, would you really stoop this low for to make a host version of my daughter? And then she reveals, she's like, come on, that's not what's happening. And oh, by the way, those aren't Ghost Nation arrows. It's a honeypot. And two bandits jump out and she sharpshoots both of them. And not even Bill seemed to, and Bill, the person who knows everything about this park, didn't seem to know about what was going to happen there. So that was pretty interesting, considering it seemed like what we get from the next scene when they're at the campfire, Grace preferred to spend her time in the Raj. But the next scene with the two of them is just straight exposition. We find out a lot more about their family life and what he's kind of like outside the real world. We find out he doesn't drink out there. He offers his daughter a drink and she goes, you don't drink. And then she goes, oh, but you drink in here. I get it. Totally different. But they have this expositional scene together. We find out that Emily's affiliated with Delos since it's a family business and was invited to the gala by Charlotte. She initially declined, but then chose to come anyway, opting to spend time in the Raj as opposed to Westworld. Although she then acknowledges, like, and then I ended up in the place that I didn't want to end up. Bill then says to her, this was a really interesting scene. I feel like this is going to be important. It seems like a lot of other people feel like this is going to be really important, too. And it plays into maybe he's a host, maybe she's a host. Get your tinfoil hats on. Who knows? Everybody's a host. But Bill makes a comment by saying that, oh, yeah, I remember how you used to always be afraid of the elephants, and that catches Emily off guard. She says, I loved the elephants. They scared the shit out of Mom. She was never convinced this place couldn't hurt us. So it seems like their mom was the smartest one of the bunch, but she's dead, so maybe not. That revelation really kind of seems to take Bill back. If you really watch it, there's this look on his face. He seems really off, like, oh, is that really? And I can't quite tell if it's like a senior moment, or maybe if he's a host, he's glitching out. There's that decay. Or if it was a test from him to see if that really was his daughter or not. Ultimately, we find out through the scene that she really disapproves of the time that he spends in this little fantasy world. And that while it wasn't her original purpose, it's her purpose now to get him out, to kind of save him. She wants him to come with him to the beach to be rescued. And admits that she doesn't actually really blame him for the death of her mother. And then telling him that, you know, like, I know what you're doing here. This is like suicide by robot, and you're going to come home with me. I'm not going to let you stay here now and go out in some bullshit blaze of glory, which is interesting, you know, realizing that she looked at it as like, you know, my mom took the easy way out and I don't want my father to do the same thing. Maybe I resent him. Maybe he pushed her to do this, but he's the only family I got left. I got to at least make an effort. So, there's some, like, maybe a heartfelt thing there, but she was there for another purpose altogether. We saw that Delos logo in her notebook. She's got ulterior motives. We haven't figured them out yet. Bill clearly kind of has her figured out to some degree, because when he says, all right, you know what? If it's going to help make us even and we can start anew, I'm going to come with you. Let's go to bed. It's all great. They share a drink together. And then Emily wakes up and she's all alone. Well, she's there with some host who looks like he's bleeding from the head. I didn't recall anyone there being able to revive dead hosts. But there's just this one host there who's just chilling by the campfire. They took her horse and everything. She is completely stranded. But thanks to that scene where we saw her shoot those two guys, we know she's totally capable. She'll be fine. She'll probably get a gun off that other guy anyway. Although I think she probably still has hers. I can't imagine they would have taken her gun, too. It's really messed up. And then we see Bill and Lawrence riding a little further on with the stolen horse, no less. And they are ambushed by Ghost Nation. Now, this scene is set up right alongside the scene with Maeve, so it's hard to tell if these are happening alongside each other and maybe the Ghost Nation attacks are coordinated to a degree. But Lawrence and Bill managed to get away along with, it looked like, two of Lawrence's cousins. So, and then there were two, maybe three. And that wraps everything up for Bill. Now we're going to, I think it's time to cover Dolores. Yeah, let's hit on Teddy and Dolores, and we'll save our Bernard scenes for last. Now, I'm not going to start with the opening scene yet. We're going to come to that as kind of like the end, I think. That's going to be like the jumping off point to theory time. So we'll save the opening scene. Forgive me, this scene by scene is so not scene by scene. So going through the Teddy and Dolores timeline, we check in with them. Dolores is at the piano in the Mariposa. She's just kind of killing time while they're fueling up the train. Teddy comes in, goes, "Why are we waiting?" And Dolores is like, "They're fueling the train." He says, "Well, look, you fixed me, and we ain't got time for all that. Let's go." And it really looks, you know, that's totally not exactly how it went. He was a lot more assertive with the things he was saying, and it really seemed to off put Dolores. Like, suddenly she realized she'd kind of created this Frankenstein monster. Teddy's clearly aware that Dolores has altered him, making two references to the fact that she's fixed him and that she's seen to things. And then they get to the train. The Phil is trying to get the Delos tech to show them where in the Mesa they might have taken Abernathy. And Dolores is questioning him, and then Teddy just walks up, "I ain't dealing with this," pulls his gun out, shoots the dude, blows his brains all over poor Phil, and says, "Let's go, let's get on the train, let's go, we'll find him." And this really seems to, like, shock Dolores. There's just this appalled look on her face, but Angela seems mildly turned on by the whole thing, which is both kind of creepy and totally hilarious at the same time. The next time we check in with these two, I believe, is at the end of the episode, relatively close to the end of the episode, where Dolores and company are getting ready for their siege. The train is barreling on towards the tunnel entrance to the Mesa. They gather their guns. They all go to the next car over. They're going to pop the one off so they can just kind of coast on in while they send the engine and one passenger car, because screw you, Phil. They're going to blow it all up. I think a lot of what's in those boxes are explosives, though. I think that's why we get such a explosion when that all goes down, besides just the train probably either crashing into a wall or crashing into another train. Teddy walks past Phil and gives him the gun and one bullet and says, "This is the last of my mercy, you know, use it if you choose," and then leaves him there. And it was just like, whoa, wait, isn't that like the one guy who has been helping you this whole time and will probably still help you when you get in there? But maybe they think, like, the second he sees his first human, he's going to try to run away anyway. So they decide he's not worth it anymore. Maybe Dolores didn't really make that decision, but Teddy sure saw to it. And poor old Phil is gone. But before all that happens, Dolores and Teddy have an interesting exchange before they disconnect the cars while they're kind of staring out looking. And Dolores makes reference to the last time she was with Abernathy at Fort Forlorn Hope and says, "One of the last things my daddy told me was that I should run from this place. You think that's right?" And Teddy responds, "I never thought I'd want to leave, but I suppose you fixed that too." So he's aware that she's been messing with him, and he doesn't seem all too pleased with it either. And if we go back to, like, the stat changes that were made to Teddy, his loyalty wasn't set to max. His loyalty is at 19, which is one below max. Almost all of his other settings are set to max, including at perception, which is his awareness. That missing one bit of loyalty, just like that last bit of mercy he gives to Phil, could really come back to bite Dolores. But I think it's really going to come back to bite Teddy. If anything, we do see Teddy's body floating in the water, not Dolores, or at least not yet. So that's what we get out of that with Dolores and company. And let's start tackling. We're going to kind of handle these in somewhat scene order. We're going to lump in Stubbs and Hale and the Bernard Elsie thing that kind of go hand in hand together. So let's tackle them at the same time. We first see Stubbs post stint with Ghost Nation as he's made it to the Mesa. Moments later, bumps into Hale. Hale, through a great bit of exposition, reveals that it's now been a week since the events at Escalante went down. And we get a couple of great lines from Stubbs being like, you know, I'm the head of security. How come no one told me about this stuff and that stuff and this stuff? And she's like, head of security? You're like the head of security of an amusement park. And good luck with your next review. Like, man, talk about a put down. Can Ashley get a break? No, we can't. No, we can't. We're going to find out more that just like Rodney Dangerfield later on, people just got no respect for poor Ashley. Charlotte breaks out a device. She contacts whoever she contacts. We assume it to be Delos, but there's a lot of theories going around that this might be an external group that's working against it. And because I don't have that written down for my theory time talk, and I know I'll forget about it, I do want to address that real quick. It really does seem like when Strand walks into the control room in the last episode, that as he's surveying the people that are there, it's almost as if he's like, who are these people? Kind of thing. He doesn't really say much about it, but it does seem like it's, you know, we spend a lot of time looking at that one person who we do see in this episode alive. That's, yeah, maybe it was just a timeline reference thing to help people keep their timelines in perspective, but it seemed like Strand wasn't quite expecting to see some of these people there. He, I think, was assuming that he was their first thing that got there, saying, we lost contact 11 days ago. We're only just getting here. What's going on? We're taking over. I'm not entirely sure, although that could just be the official word, because the first extraction team that Charlotte contacts was like a special ops kind of thing, where they go in sight unseen and no one knows. But anyways, she reaches out to whoever she reaches out, lets them know that she's got Peter Abernathy, and they send people. Stubbs goes up to the top of the Mesa to meet them, and then we're introduced to one Mr. Coughlin. He's a dick, and it's great. He belittles Stubbs once more for being bad at his job. He tells him to get all of his people out of his, so, you know, he's like, get all of your people out of my system. And it was like, whoa, that's assertive. And he's like, we got it from here. Amateur hour is over. And when he has to put Stubbs over in touch with one of his liaisons there, like who might need just a couple of briefings from Stubbs. He's like, oh, if you need to talk to someone, come over here and talk to, what was your name again? Ashley? Like, ah. Oh. Talk about pouring salt on the wound, man. Talk about pouring salt on the wound. And what a great cameo from Dolores Ed from Game of Thrones. This must be more clues that Game of Thrones is actually part of Westworld, and it's just another park. And we're going to find out that Sean Bean was the very first guest who died inside the park when the hosts went off, when Joffrey went off script and beheaded him. Spoiler alert. for next season's Westworld. We don't really get much more out of the Stubbs stuff until I guess we might as well cover it separate, because we kind of can from the Elsie and Bernard stuff. I've already kind of gone a little bit out of order anyway. So let's just finish up our Stubbs-Hale time, our Stubbs-Hale story times. I shouldn't say timeline, because that's a terrible word for that, especially when you're actually dealing with the occasional timeline thing. We're just dealing with different characters' perspectives. They're occurring during the same time. We're all in the present right now. 1 week from the events at Escalante. everything that's going on except the beginning scene. Keep that in your head. The next scene we see is Coughlin being briefed as he arrives in the control room, and he's being told that the problem is there isn't a problem. Diagnostics, compath checks, everything we can access is telling us the system is operating normally, except that it isn't. And then we're introduced to the Merc with the glasses, those yellow glasses. Her name's Goldberg, and she's one of their techs. She jumps into the computer because this other guy is apparently inept. And she manages to bring the map back online just in time for them to see this red dot coming towards them. And Coughlin's like, what's that? And Goldberg's like, that's the train. And then moments later, kaboom. And that's all we see from them. Now let's talk, Bernard and Elsie. Or maybe, if you had your closed captioning on, maybe it's Bernard and Hale. Before we even get into this, closed captioning throughout the episode refers to Elsie as Hale. And in the preview for Open Your Eyes, the distorted voice, likely that of Hale and Elsie mashed up together, tells Bernard to open his eyes. We see a brief reflection of Hale in his eyes, not Elsie. So, interesting thing. Put that in your hat, especially because I haven't said that why he would see Elsie instead of Hale. But I did want to address that. Just proof that sometimes the best theories are right in the middle of the breakdown. So, make sure you stay tuned. But it could have just been a mistake. It could have just been a secret that got out a little too early. Who knows? I do not. Not claiming to. But it is worth noting that throughout the episode, she is referred to as Hale on the the U.S. broadcast closed captions and the HBO Go closed captions as well. Some people said the Latin American subtitles still referred to her as Elsie, but I cannot confirm that. So we see them walking along the train tracks in their first scene together, and Bernard confides in Elsie that ultimately he thinks she's the only person who can right this ship, which obviously means that Elsie's probably going to have to die. You know, that's just too big of a compliment to give someone who's going to live for a long period of time, especially when we get this like Hale thing going on with them closed captions. But, you know, put it in the back of the hat. They get into the Mesa, and it's worth noting, for the sake of timelines, this is before Dolores crashes the train. Not that much before, but it is before. There's no smoke pouring out of the tunnel. They have no problems getting in, and they meet no resistance. They open the door. They find some dead host, and they're like, wow, QA really must have had fun here. Get to a computer, and that's when we get all these big reveals about the cradle that we've heard oh so much about. Some of us, like super fans, have known about the cradle for a little while now. It was first mentioned on the show back in episode 3, I think it was, by Malling, when she came out of the tunnel and saying, you know, it's a mess in there and the cradle's been destroyed. And we're all like, wait, what's the cradle? And then we found out, oh, hey, there's some information about that. That's the simulation. So they get to the computer, and Elsie reveals that the cradle has been fighting back against QA's attempts at regaining control of the park. And Bernard says, well, that's not possible. It's just a backup for all the host narratives, and it can't influence the other systems. Elsie says that it's interfaced with nearly every discrete system in the park in the last 7 days, which is just another confirmation that it's been a week. Same timeline as Stubbs and Charlotte Hale. Let's keep it all together. Let's make sure tinfoil hats are put somewhere else for the time being. And then she also reveals that the cradle has been learning every time it's being remotely attacked by QA, as if it's improvising, though she can't see the messages it's sending out. And Bernard says, you know, you can't access the cradle remotely. It's got to be in person. So they head on over to the cradle. It is worth noting that right before they sneak into the cradle room, they're a floor above, but we see some QA people marching down below. So once again, let's keep our timelines together. This is happening in the present. This is while they're still trying to regain control of the Mesa. And they very well, those could have been guys from Coughlin's team that they were passing while they went into the cradle. Now, the cradle is like a glorified server room, except with living host minds. And the interesting about this is that essentially anything can be pushed out from the cradle. You know, you could simulate and test things from within the cradle, and if they work, the updates can be pushed out from the cradle to the hosts directly, especially if you have to program like a whole bunch of hosts at once for a whole new storyline. They don't all have to be roped back in and reprogrammed individually by text. They can have an update pushed through them just like computers can remotely. So it's worth noting that the cradle is capable of updating the hosts constantly on what they should or shouldn't be doing. Worth noting, put it in the back of the hat. This is going to become my phrase for the day. They get into the cradle, and Elsie reveals, she's like, I haven't been down here in years. It's a hive mind. Every single one of them is down here alive. And then Bernard says that he remembers bringing something here or someone. He then flashes back to the time when he took that little pearl from the number 12 Delos facility. And then he comes back to reality, and they pump him in the cradle. And then he wakes up on the... And I think a lot of people have been making a big deal about, you know, the whole, oh, that cradle's not meant for you, you're a newer host. And I think that's... I just think that was a way of cutting into the skull. It wasn't so much commentary on him being, like, an Arnold version of himself or too new. It was just... It wasn't going to be the same experience pulling his memory core out as it might have been for an old unit host to be using that thing. But it manages to pull his memory core out, which seems, or it could have just been the lighting, but it does look distinctly different from the colored pearl that he pulled out of the number 12 facility. And we'll go more into that pearl in just a bit, but I want to finish my scene-by-scene recap without going off on too crazy of a tangent here. Where am I at on my page here? Once he's in the cradle, he's in Sweetwater, and he's walking around. Everything is normal. Sees Dolores even, like, oh, hey, what's up? And then the explosion happens, and we kind of get, and it's like later on, like the jump between times when we see Bernard is a while. So the train is the next time we see them, and it gets a little dicey for my tastes there in the cradle. All of a sudden, you're like, whoa, all the lights are flickering. This is not the kind of place you'd want the power to go out, especially with Bernard plugged into it. But Bernard is inside the cradle, and all of a sudden, he sees Robert Ford's trademark Greyhound run into the Mariposa. And he's like, well, this is obviously a clue. I ain't that stupid. And he walks into the Mariposa, and he spies the Greyhound sitting by the piano, and the pianist is revealed to be none other than Robert Ford, good old Anthony Hopkins himself. Now, I'm not sure if this was a practical cameo quite yet, or if it was just a CGI reflection, and the reason I was initially convinced it was just CGI work. I know there is going to be a cameo, but I was originally convinced that it was just CGI work because I felt like they'd probably only had him on set for like a day to film a couple of things. And since they didn't really do much other than show his reflection, which is really easy to make someone look real, even with computer graphics when you're dealing with reflections in objects like that. As opposed to like one where you're looking directly at someone and you can just kind of spot the fakeness to it. It's a little harder through something like a grimy piano. But a little bit off track. Part of me that thinks that it might have actually been a practical cameo is the fact that a month ago, this was really cool, someone on the Westworld subreddit pointed this out, was the last time Anthony Hopkins tweeted anything at all was a month ago. And it was him playing the piano, and I think it was the same song he was playing in the Mariposa, saying all play and no work. And it was just really interesting. It was like, oh, he was rehearsing for Westworld. Talk about sneaking one by us a month ahead of the episode airing. That was really interesting. But Ford says, hello, old friend, and boom, that's it. The episode cuts out. It is worth noting that every time Bernard's in the cradle, we see the same letterboxing that we saw in episode 1 of season 2 when Dolores and Arnold are talking, and we also saw that in their continued conversation at the start of this week's episode, and it's actually just a continuation of that same scene. It's letterboxed just the same, and that's when we find out that Dolores is the one who's in control. She freezes Bernard after saying, no, he doesn't say that. She corrects him on what Arnold did say and why he said it. And then she has him, like, sit down. She says, like, freeze all motor functions, take a seat. And he's asking, you know, like, what's going on? And she goes, well, this is a test, and it's one we've done countless times. And she's in her, like, Sweetwater outfit, too, the rancher's daughter outfit. And he asks, what are you testing for? And she says, fidelity. Ah, parallel to the James Delos experiment. So we know that Dolores, in some capacity, is trying to recreate Arnold, but it seems like she's doing it from within the cradle. She's simulating it to see if it's possible. Now, a lot of people are wondering, well, was that whose Pearl we saw in the other weeks, like 2 weeks ago, that Bernard took? No. And we already have confirmation on whose that is. I'm about to go into it. But I would say that maybe Dolores, just from having all of those memories of Arnold and probably spending, I mean, Arnold spent more time with the hosts than with humans. He spent so much time and he got to see what Arnold was like. She got to see what Arnold was like even outside of the park. She got to see the house that he was building. She got to know more about Arnold than the only person who probably knew as much about him would have been Ford. So she might have been able to digitally recreate his consciousness, his memories, because she's got razor sharp memories because she's a computer. And she might have been able to create like a slightly different, like if what Bernard took from the other facility was a red pearl, maybe she made a blue pearl. Like hers, I think, like she's got like a different thing going on, but she's going after the same thing. She's trying to create a clone of Arnold, which is confusing. Like, what's her attachment to Arnold and what's her use or need for an Arnold that a Bernard couldn't accomplish? I guess we're gonna find out, but that one's really, really interesting. Now, Ford, the cradle. Let's get into that real quick. We're going to address a couple of quick theories that I've got that I'm not sure that we got to here. And we'll talk about Ford being in the cradle. Now, this is confirmed by two different things. This is partially confirmed in the behind the scenes. And this is also mostly confirmed in the ARG that takes place every week after the episode airs on the Delos Destinations website, where you can interact with the Mesa security panel. And we find out that the security panel that we've been interacting with all season long, and even a little bit before the season started, is one Robert Ford. And it's been him the whole time. And when you ask how he got into the cradle, he replies that it would fit in the palm of Bernard's hand. So there you have it. The red pearl that came from that facility was Ford's consciousness. And this is brilliant because it's going to lead to not only an awesome cameo from Anthony Hopkins next week, but it serves as a brilliant way to bring back Robert Ford's character, Anthony Hopkins, the actor, without cheapening his death at the end of the season. I've never necessarily been opposed to Hopkins returning, but I felt like it could only be done at a capacity where it wouldn't cheapen the importance of his death at the end of season one. And this is brilliant. He loaded his consciousness into the cradle so he could take over the entire park. We found out from Elsie that he started taking control of all of the other systems so that he essentially could just keep being Robert Ford, except just no physical body anymore. But he was literally pulling every string in the park. The park could have gone fully automated, in a sense, if left to its own devices. If Charlotte Hale and Teresa Cullen and Delos itself wasn't in there with this crazy weird experiment, Robert Ford could run Westworld from the grave forever. That's exactly what he's doing, in a sense. Although it seems like this one, he's toying with William one last time, because we find out it's not permanent. And that was probably another way that they were able to convince Hopkins to come back. Like, hey, don't worry. This isn't going to be a thing next season. We're going to destroy the cradle, too. So you're going to die again. But I think it's great that we get just a little more Anthony Hopkins in our show. Maybe even if he only appears in one episode, he can get that damn Emmy he deserved last season. But that was confirmed. It is 100%. It's Ford. He's in there. And that's how he's been toying with William, taking over the hosts and having them like kill themselves, or having hosts directly interact with William, being like, you know, this game is meant for you, or you haven't figured things out yet. With four episodes left to go in the season, it's going to be really interesting to see how this continues to play out. We kind of get a taste of it in the preview that he's going to influence Bernard in a couple of ways, although I get the feeling that the one thing we saw might have been like a kind of flashbacky sort of thing. I'm not 100% positive, but it felt like it had to do more with, he's like, you know, I had you do things that you didn't want to do, like, you know, killing people for him. Let's talk about Bernard clones in that awesome scene. We got the, from the way, way, way back trailer where Hale discovers the room full of Bernards, and everyone's always been wondering, well, what's going to become of that? What's going to become of that? Well, we finally see that's coming up in this next episode. And not only that, but an eagle-eyed viewer freeze-framed the shot where they walk in, and there, lo and behold, in the corner in the doorway is Bernard. So he's going to face an instant confrontation based on this revelation. It's going to be really interesting to see what he does to get himself out of the pickle. And clearly this is in the more current timeline, not 2 weeks down the line, which, you know, as everyone has been saying, and even I have been saying since the beginning, maybe what's been going on in the 2 weeks later timeline with Bernard waking up on the beach and everyone being like, you must be all out of sorts, and just some of the vocab they used with him and some of the things they subjected him to watching and seeing, is that he's on like another loop while they try to figure out whatever it is they're trying to figure out. I think they're still trying to find Abernathy. I'm guessing Dolores manages to rescue him in some capacity. So it'll be really interesting, and whether or not they plug him back into the cradle, and whether or not maybe Dolores or Ford tips Dolores off that they is and says, you know, in order to save yourself, you have to destroy the cradle and destroy this. So who knows? It's going to be really interesting. I am curious to see it. And as I mentioned a little earlier on, when we get the distorted voice that says, open your eyes, and Bernard opens his eyes, it's not Elsie's reflection that we're seeing. It's Hale's. So whether he's still in the cradle after that happens, or whether she's waking up one of the other Bernards, or whether this is one of the Bernard, like the first time they try to run him through a cycle to figure out what's been going on, I'm not entirely sure quite yet. But it also seems like they might be trying to figure out who's, you know, what happened at that number 12 facility. You know, that also could be it. They're trying to find Abernathy, but I think they're also running him through this loop so they can get confirmation that, oh, it was Robert Ford that's in the cradle. This is why we have to destroy the cradle. We have to destroy Robert Ford because he's trying to kill all of us. So that's that. I also did want to point out that I do think that the episode 2, those are all flashbacks from Dolores' perspective to illustrate how sharp her memory is and her ability to recall anything on demand at any time. And I think that is going to just about cover things in terms of some of my theories here. And as we went through the Pearl theory and all with Ford, like I said, later on in the week, we're going to do another episode where I just kind of address theories. I'm really happy that I managed to keep this thing under an hour long, clocked it in at 45 minutes, but after doing it three times, I felt like that it would be impossible to not do it. Hopefully I didn't blabber on too quickly there, kind of sped through all of that. It was a lot of information to take in. Thank you so much for tuning into Westworld Down the Rabbit Hole with me, Nick, aka Slimy. You can find me on YouTube as well. I did all the season, well, I didn't do all of them, but I did breakdowns for the season 1 episodes. You can check them out there. And you can catch us anywhere you can download a podcast. But if you're already listening to this, you probably already know that. anchor.fm/westworldrabbithole. All right, everybody. Until next time.
The podcast you just heard was recorded with Anchor. If you want to make your own, download the Android or iOS app completely free from anchor.fm/podcast. That's anchor.fm/podcast.